Hi, welcome to Colonial Williamsburg, past and present on history.org. This is Behind the Scenes, where you meet the people who work here. That's my job. I'm Lloyd Dobbins, and mostly I ask questions. This time I'm asking Doc Hassel, and at Colonial Williamsburg, he's Master Brass Founder. And I think I know what that means, but when people talk about founders around here, there's so many different kinds that you get confused.
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of people have an image in their minds of what a founder is, but I think in a lot of cases it's more of an industrial vision that they have of a big iron steel foundry. But foundries are sort of like smithing shops, that there are a lot of different kinds. And what a foundry is really is just any place that is doing metal work by melting the metal and then pouring it.
Oh, pouring so, it yeah, into a mold.
Casting, exactly.
Casting, yeah, okay.
Exactly. So okay. Smiths, on the other hand, usually were hammering, forging the metal.
Yeah, they would heat it to make it malleable and then
beat it. But we heat it beyond that point to where it's liquid. It actually melts, and then, as you said, we construct molds and then pour the metal into that.
So let me see if I've got this right. You get used brass. You can melt that again and re-pour it?
You can. Pretty much most metals, I guess, you can melt down and recast without hurting them. In the colonial period, that was the principal source of metal because there was so little mining being done in the colonies.
And
You could import raw metal from England. It in most cases wasn't illegal, but it was taxed generally. The idea, that a colony was supposed to be more of a market for English manufacturers, and we would be supplying raw material going back to England. So they didn't tax the finished goods that left England, but they did tax raw metal. But we could get around it by just buying up old, broken, worn-out pieces, things that had been made earlier, and melt it, rework it. So.
And it's pretty much any kind of metal that you needed.
Yeah, we in the shop I work in, we're working a variety of metals because this shop in the 18th century also worked a lot of different metals. The foundry that we work in was originally operated by the Getty family for a period of about 50 years during the 18th century. And although it was normally advertised as a brass foundry, they also did do bronze alloys, which commonly are worked with brass anyway because they're both copper-based alloys. And they also did precious metals casting, mainly silver, I think largely because there was a member of the Getty family, James Getty, who was a silversmith.
Yeah, well, that would explain that.
Right, so his brother is actually the ones who ran the foundry. So they would do all the silver casting for him. We still do a lot of silver cast pieces for the silversmiths in cases where they have a part of something, maybe a spout to a coffee pot or a border to a tray, and it's something that would be awkward or unprofitable to try to hammer out. And, they might do their own casting, but if a foundry's convenient, a smith often will just farm that out. So we do a lot of work even today for the silversmiths in Williamsburg.
Normal week, normal period of time.
Okay.
What would you cast?
Well, there again, tremendous variety. In general, the kind of shop we have and the Getty brothers ran was referred to as a small works foundry. So they weren't making just one type of thing. They weren't a candlestick maker or a buckle maker, but a wide variety of pieces. They might do candlesticks, buckles, furniture hardware, coach work and harness work, bells, sword hilts, gun parts, door knockers, sundials, all of those are things actually that we know were done in the shop and in the 18th century and that we still have done in modern times.
If it's metal and small.
And cast.
And
it's a shape that was made by casting, by pouring, then we might do it.
You could, if you felt like it, do it.
And in all likelihood, probably have at some point. We've even done parts for an 18th century fire engine. Some years ago, a lot of the trade shops worked together, and we built a replica of a 1750 model Newsome fire engine. We did all the casting, you know, the pump cylinders and valves and piping and so on. That was an unusual job, probably something that would have been done in England rather than the colonies, but it was an interesting aspect.
You know, you don't think of that, but if you have things like 18th century fire engines, which, if I remember correctly, are basically wood, but they have to have fittings on them or it won't work.
Right. The parts that actually most part handle the water or something like that would be metal, right? So the pressure tanks and, like I say, valves and, you know, the actual pumping mechanism.
Yeah, but that was fun.
Yeah, that was. That was just one of many, you know, odd jobs you get in the course of the work we do.
How long have you done that?
I've been doing it for 38 years in the fall, all with Williamsburg. I served an apprenticeship in the foundry where I work now under Sven Berg, who was master before me for many years. And as you probably know, all the trade shops in Williamsburg utilize the apprentice system, and it's usually a period of some years. Our case, usually 5-6 years. No, it's a lengthy period.
A tailor's apprentice told me recently that his was 7 years.
It varies. It varies with the person. In the 18th century, of course, it was an individual contract that had been signed, and there were certain sort of common, you know, periods. But in many cases, it depended on when you started the apprenticeship, because they often ended at 21. Not always, but frequently. So if you started when you were 15, it was a 6-year apprenticeship. If you started when you were 12,
16, it was 5 years.
Right,
yeah, okay.
Right. So,
yeah. That makes a certain amount of sense. On the theory that by the time you get to be 21, you pretty well ought to know what you're going to do.
If you started when you were 12, you probably did.
I guess, any other fun thing like the fire engine? That really fascinates me.
Well, I don't know. We get a lot of jobs that perhaps are not odd items, but that we might make one time and then never have to make again. I mean, I've made things like ice cream molds for the kitchens, pieces that they just need for a particular place in the historic area. And so often today, things that are needed in the museum are not available. I mean, the 18th century, you could go to a store and buy what you needed. Now, we often have to... tradesmen in Williamsburg often have to make the things that are...
I mean, you can still go to a store, but there's nothing there that you need.
It's not going to look like what we need, exactly. Exactly.
So all the little thing, little metal things around here probably come out of your foundry.
Well, the other people, not always, because you have a lot of things that are, of course, made by the blacksmiths. In fact, they probably do more general hardware than we do. The iron being more of a functional metal in many ways. It wasn't as expensive as brass or bronze. It was stronger. And, you know, so many of the hardware fixtures around town, architectural hardware and so on, is done by the blacksmith. But you will see a lot of our work around. We'll see it furniture hardware. You'll see it on the coaches and carriages. We just recently did a set of buckles ranging from really big main brace buckles to much smaller ones, door handles and so on for the newest coach that we got, which was the one that represents the Royal Governor's coach, the Dunmore coach. So if you happen to be out and around and you see that red and brown coach with the beautiful, huge brass buckles, those are our buckles.
You are there working away, and visitors wander through the door. What are they curious about?
Well, a lot depends on, you know, the visitors. Sometimes they come with certain areas of curiosity, but a lot of times it'll just depend on what it is that we're doing at the time, the ongoing work. And, of course, that, in a sense, is the way that we design our approach to history, is we actually have working trade shops, and the visitor is able to walk into a shop, find actual living artisans that are practicing, you know, an 18th century trade, same tool, same process, and whatever's going on is the thing that likely is going to, you know, to attract their attention and elicit questions. Our additional charge, though, is also to use that sort of as a springboard. You know, we want to talk not just about what we're doing at the moment, but a broader look at the trade and a broader look at the people that practiced the trade and the society at large, you know, how they fit into the community.
I must be slow today, but it finally occurred to me, if you cast something, there's also a lot of handwork after it's cast.
An enormous amount.
File it down or smooth it off or
filing,
whatever you call it.
Scraping, sanding, polishing, fitting, assembly. Often 90% of the work time is in that. It's also a fair amount of time making molds. The molds that we employ for the hotter metals, the metals like brass and bronze and silver, those are actually not permanent molds. They're made from a molding sand, as it's called. It's actually a sand with about a fifth part clay, which acts as the binder for it. But they're good only for one pour. So, you know, every casting that we make, we actually do have to make a separate mold for it.
So if you molded something, I don't care, but it's a brass mold.
All right.
The molds might not be exactly the same.
Well, they will for the most part, because that's a good point you bring up, that you'll see in our work we often do make duplicates. We make a pair of candlesticks. They're pretty close. But when you make a sand mold, you're not carving in the sand. In fact, that's actually impossible. The sand isn't even as moldable as clay. You have to shape it by packing the sand over a model, what we call a pattern. So when we make a new piece, the first thing we do is make that pattern, which sometimes we'll do it in a soft metal, just, you know, working directly, hammering, filing, whatever. Sometimes we'll carve it in wood or turn it on the lathe in wood. Sometimes we might model it in wax or clay or use a plaster cast. Probably wood and metal, the most common pattern. But once we have a pattern, we can use that over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So, because that never comes in contact with the hot metal.
That's right.
That's only the stuff, the clay and the sand.
The idea, when you make the sand mold, you make it in sections. So you have at least a two-part mold. You know, envision a book or something you can open up. So after you've packed sand on either side, you can open the mold up again, remove the pattern, and then you reassemble the mold to actually pour in.
Okay, now that's how we get two duplicate items,
because 100 or whatever.
You've got a pattern,
right?
And you build the mold around it, so it's going to turn out looking pretty much like the pattern. So
exactly. And you can also have multiple patterns. This morning, we were making molds for casting just little copper rivets that are used by our coopers in making kegs and barrels that are going to be used for storing gunpowder. And in that case, they don't use iron, because when they're repairing them at some point, you don't want to strike a spark. So it's all copper.
Well, you don't want to strike if you want to continue doing your business.
But with something like rivets, small little pieces, we put in about 15 or 20 maybe in the mold. We make duplicate patterns. So instead of having just one pattern, we'll make, you know, as I say, 10, 15, 20 of them. And that way, each mold will have that many. So that's as close as we get to mass production, but it does speed up.
Well, I wouldn't call 10 mass, but
maybe not a mass, right?
A lot of production.
That's right.
That's Colonial Williamsburg, past and present this time. Check history.org often. We'll post more for you to download and hear.